see.
Go on, Scott.
Go. Thanks for that. My name's Scott, I'm an addict. I feel like the bloke who's at the front of the fun fair ride he's queued for 2 hours for, and he's just about to go, do you know what, I don't actually want to go on this ride. After all, we get back off again. Daniel asked me on Sunday, we texted me on Sunday, and my first thought was about time two. My second thought was, we blew it out. And then the third thought was, yeah, go on, give it a go, why not? This is my home from home group. I live 70 miles from here, and I'm here at least two Fridays a month. And I work in Winchester, so I come from Winchester, drive straight past, well, train straight past my house, come all the way here, and then I go way back home again. I've gone further to school on a Friday night, and it's actually quite cheap, at £20 on a train. I'm sitting there, how am I going to do this? And I thought, do you know what, the best way to do it is just roll with it. Right. Normal childhood. Mum and dad split when I was a kid, so did everyone else where I lived in Stepney. Things just happened as a kid, happened to kids, it weren't no big deal. And then I was 12 years old, it was on my 12th birthday, and one of my friends, a really good friend at the time, I think, gave me a tube of glue and a crisp bag. It was before we went to school that morning. And this is not the progression of the illness or anything else like that, but what happened is I sniffed on this bag, and I loved it so much. What it was the answer to my questions, and they were questions I'd never even asked. From that moment, I found the answer. I don't know what the question was, but I found the answer. This is what I wanted to do from now on in. And from that moment, everyone went to school and I didn't. From that moment, I started using in various guises, and I stopped doing everything else. I stopped being a son, I stopped being a brother, I stopped going to school, I just stopped. And I just started doing whatever I did. And it got really silly, really, really quick. And within, sort of, by the time I was 13, 14, my mum was walking around with her handbag under her arm, locking doors after her. I had my front door key taken off me. All these little points I'm bringing up were actually for a reason, because there's a big circle gone in my life. And by the time I was 15, she said she couldn't do this anymore. And decided she'd give me all my clothes in a bin liner and a £5 note. And this was 1983. And all I remember thinking to myself is, all you got to do is say, Mum, I'm really, really sorry, I won't do this again, and I can walk back in the house. And my head would say to me, you can do whatever you like now, and you've got no one to answer to. And the head won. And I just walked away from my mum's front door. And what I thought I'd like to do from that moment, within not too long a time, I didn't like doing, but I couldn't stop doing. I got myself a habit. I was doing things I didn't want to do. I'm happy sharing it now. I wouldn't share it at all in the first year, two, three, four, five, six. And my current sponsor I've been with for 4.5 years now is the only person I actually shared it with in step four. And I've done step fours before, and basically, and I still wasn't willing to actually part with this information. I used to sell myself around here. I wasn't a very good thief, so basically, but I was a pretty little boy. And that was my ways and means. And that's what I did for a long time, from the age of about 16 till I was about 20, 21. And I lost a lot of friends in that time. It's not my proudest moment. It's not for after dinner conversation with my mum. She doesn't need to know about it. She's never going to get a recording of this. But the thing is, it's part of my story. And again, that's another thing that comes up in the future. And what it was is, it was all a bit of shit, to be honest. And I did that, as I said, for a long time. And I was in a squat over in Acne. And someone came in and turned around and said to me that one of my friends had just been found dead in a lay-by. Been thrown out of a car dead, and I just had a hit there and then, and I thought, you know what, I can't do this anymore. And I jumped straight out this window, it was four floors up, and a big bay window in the squat, and it was all scaffolded out, but there was no balls, it was just poles. I didn't know that, I just jumped out the window. And I came out the window and I bounced off all the bars, which actually cushioned my fall, but broke all my ribs, shattered my collarbone, broke both my knees, more about them later. And a scaffold pole ended up hanging out my chest. And that was on November the 27th, 1991, and I was in a coma for 17 days. And I came out of coma December the 14th of that year, and I stayed in hospital right up to about the March, April of the following year. And they repaired me as best they could. And I came out of the hospital in May 92, completely signed off from discharge from hospital, and I said, I'm never going to use those drugs, do those things, worrying about those people ever again. And I never did. I got to NA 17 years later. And that's 17 years. Five psychiatric hospitals, three treatment centres, how many detoxes I don't even want to think about, failed relationships, lost jobs, breakdowns, all sorts of stuff. But I didn't have a problem because I wasn't doing those things with those people. And it wasn't until I finally actually got here and I actually heard in my first meeting the reading we substitute one for another, and it was like, dull. And I didn't know. I just didn't get it. And as I said, in those 17 years, the one thing that Scott's always been able to do, I don't like talking about myself in the third person, but basically is I've always managed to get it together. My problem is I can't keep it together. My problem's always been is I get it just how I like it and then I explode it. I snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. I get the relationship just right and then I'll have an affair. I'll get the job just right and I'll get caught nicking at the job or taking abuse from the company card or something. And it was just that thing and I just did that over and over again. And the only honest words that ever came out of my mouth is when my mum, my sister, my now wife and anyone would just say, "What is wrong with you?" And I just go, "I don't know." And I genuinely didn't know. But when I was on a good day and I was doing things properly, I'd have bought me a drink. I was a nice bloke. But they became less and less these times. And that was just basically how it worked out. And as I said, I went back to school after I had this crippling jumping out of window malarkey. And I'd done evening classes. And then I went and I did a degree. I graduated by the time I was 30. I subsidised my degree by serving up to freshers. They'll come to London to study, and I came home, got more habits. But anyway, you know, the thing is, I was doing business studies, it meant it was business. And I qualified, and I graduated, and I got a job in the city. That's what I'm saying, I've got it all together again. And the thing, the drugs were still coming, they never went away. I worked out, by the day I actually stopped, the last drug I overtook, I'd never had a whole day between that first drug on the 12th of 19th September 1979, my 12th birthday, to the day I stopped on the 19th of June 2009. In between then, there wasn't one day there wasn't something floating around my system. Be it pharmaceutical, be it chemical, be it powder, be it alcohol, be it whatever it was, there was something going through my body at any given time for 3 months short of 30 years. So I come in a little bit battered, to say the least. And the thing is, I never said I had a habit apart from that initial habit, but I had a habit because it was just whatever it was. Give me, I'd be with dealers, and I'd go, "What are they?" Find out when I've taken five of them and then wake up in A&E and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, it came to a point, I'll get to the chase because my recovery war story pisses on my using one. If anyone knows me, seriously, it does. But basically, it came to a point in the end of 2008, I had a job in the city, and what had happened is that I'd let down about three or four really good employers, and I'd got good jobs, and a mate of mine gave me a job, and he said to me, he said, "Don't let me down." He said, "Look," he said, "your bridge is all burnt, I'm doing you a favour, and I'm putting my neck on the line for you." And he was really good pals with me and my missus, and he was just trying to keep it together. And I went and I ballsed it up. And I couldn't tell my missus, I ballsed it up again. And I went to work every day for the next 6 weeks when I didn't have a job. And I used to get on the train. We were living out in Braintree at the time. And I think we moved out to Essex in 2000 because she thought if we moved out there, that would get me away from all the bad boys and all the bad things that I was doing here. And we moved out to a place where the drugs were crap. So all I did then was I was going up and down the M11 or on the trains, basically scoring in London and going backwards and forwards all the time. And I remember one particular time going to a dealer and that one, scoring, and then doing it all on the train before I got as far as Wetham, going over the bridge, going the train back to Stratford, to Loughton, to score again, getting a bit more, and then what I'd do is I'd put it in a bubble wrap envelope and I'd post it to myself, just to make sure some got home. I thought it was ingenious, that I could do as much as I wanted to do, knowing that there was still a little bit left when I got home, and then the following morning sitting at the door like a dog waiting for the postman. I thought it was forward thinking. I mean, and when it didn't arrive for a day, because the post was like, and I did this thing over and over again. In the end, as I said, basically, I got this job that I won't go into anymore. And we get on the train together in the morning, and I'd kiss the tower at Stratford, and she'd go on to Liverpool Street to her job, and I'd get the next train back to Braintree. I'd be sitting in a Witherspoons at 9 o'clock in the morning in a pinstripe suit, with a pint of Stella, Jack Daniels that I'd bought on a credit card because I didn't have any money, looking around at the unemployed and unemployable, thinking I'm better than all these. And they had more money than me. And I didn't know where I was going to pay these debts and the rest of it, and I just carried on getting myself more and more. And what I did is I paid for us to go to Cuba on a holiday. And while we were there, we were having Valentine's together. And this is me when I'm at my worst, sitting having a Valentine's dinner with my wife, and said to her, "Just want to let you know I haven't got a job and I haven't been to work for the last 6 weeks. I choose my moments." She weren't happy. It's an all-inclusive holiday. She locked me out, and I thought, "I'll show her. I'll get really drunk." I was drunk already, but I'll get really drunk. And I carried on drinking, and I met a guy on the beach, and he said to me, "Yeah, some powder." And I said, "Okay, I'll have." He went, "Be very careful." I went, "Shut up, I've been doing that for years." He went, "Seriously, because Venezuela on a clear day, be careful." I was like, "Yeah, I know. And I ate this stuff, and all I remember is I could have pulled my top lip over my head, it's so strong. And I woke up, I was in Varadero, and I woke up in Havana 3 days later, and I was getting the last rites. And again, basically, I got into those situations. The holiday's supposed to have ended on February 25th. We finally got home on March the 17th. I got operated on in Cuba, they saved my life. But the surgery nearly killed me. I got flown to Miami. It's a long story, and I've got a passport to prove it. It sounds a bit mad, but I did. And I ended up in hospital in Jackson Memorial in Miami, where they put me in an induced coma, and then thereafter basically saved me. While I was in there, two guys come into the room one night, and they said they were Narcotics Anonymous, H&I. I went, yeah, what's that mean? And I didn't know what they meant. And they started saying that, just to let you know that this has happened to other people in this room, in this ward, and I went, look, I said, till you've been through what I've been through, go away, I'm not interested. You don't know what it's like. And I dismissed it, and I came back a couple of times, and I left a couple of seats. I remember seeing Am I an Addict IP there, and there was a couple of other things. I remember looking, yeah, right, okay. But the thing is, the seed was obviously planted, because I came home in the March and I was in treatment by June the 5th and I got my first day clean by June the 19th. Now, there was a few things happened between me coming back and me going into treatment, like carrying on where I left off, and I had another war story. And then my wife, who had been going to another fellowship, she's not an addict, step one of her fellowship was on Paris over the bastard who tried to ruin my life, or words to that effect. And she'd been going there for a little while, and I'd not even bothered about what she'd done, because to be quite honest, she was out of the house, meant I had more time on my own to do what I wanted to do. And she starts, these people started telling her to leave me. And I was going like, you can't leave me, you need me. She needed me, though she needed a hole in the head. But anyway, basically, what happened was I was going to her company. This is where I'm very, 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 very blessed, basically. I'm blessed, put this way, I'm here despite me, not because of me. I shouldn't be here anyway. Her company, she's now worked for 23 years. My missus is a stayer. She's been with me 22 years, and she's been with this company 23 years. They're a very big law firm, and they said, like, for you to remain a fantastic employee, what we're going to do is we're going to put your pisser junkie husband in treatment, and we're going to see how it works out and see if that puts you back on an even keel. So they paid for me to go into his private treatment, which was really all nice, and I took absolute liberties in there because I hadn't paid for it, I hadn't worked for it, it was given to me on a plate. And I did a detox in there, and I was being taken to meetings, all different fellowships, because I was in Chelmsford, and basically whatever fellowship was happened to be the busiest that night they took us to. I remember my first NA meeting. I did say to Penny I was going to name drop one. Well, I'm not going to name her, but one of her sponsors, there's a lady there who knows her as well, was at my first. I got chaperoned into this meeting by a psychiatric nurse, and I'm doing a shuffle like that, and this woman came up to me and gave me a big hug, and she went, this might be the best thing you've ever done for yourself. I went, you're mental, she went, and you're in your pyjamas. that was my introduction to her, like, as proper hug. And a very good friend of mine was actually doing a chair tonight, and I don't remember too much apart from, as I said, substitute one for another, what that woman said, and the guy who was sharing said a couple of things and made me think, that rings a bell. Oh, that sounds like me. Oh, that was actually a bit naughty. My detox finished on the 18th of June while I was in there, and I went to the counter in the morning where you go and get your meds, and they told me, there's nothing for you. So I said, sorry. They went, your detox is finished. I went, have another look. I went, turn the page over, just have another page. They went, no, it's done. I went, seriously, you went, it's done. And I went, sorry. So I said, I worked out this was going to be the day that I was going to be stopped using, or the day that I was not going to have any drugs in any shape or form. And I took me to a meeting that night in Chelmsford, and I was in bits. And I got to, I got about 9 o'clock after the meeting. We went back to the hospital where I was in, and they just switched over the doctors in the evening, like, to cover over the night shift. And I just remember sitting there, and the doctor, he's only a small guy, and it's not my style, but I remember just picking him up and saying, look, if you don't give me something, you're going to go through a wall. And he weighed about the pros and cons, and he gave me one little Arazi pan. I mean, it didn't touch the size, but guess what? I beat the system. I scored. And I went to bed quite pleased with myself. And I woke up the following morning, and all hell broke loose, and they just sort of said, like, look, at the end of the day, you threatened a member of staff, you've intimidated other patients, we might have to let you out of here. And what they did is they said, look, one of your peers is going to take you down to breakfast. And we used to all go as a group. And it was a psychiatric hospital I was in. It wasn't a treatment centre, it was a psychiatric hospital. And there was four different wards, and we didn't actually really see each other too much in what we were doing. And it's the first time I saw a lot of these people, and it was an eating disorder ward. There was a load of children who had really, really sort of terrible problems going on. And there was another wall we used to cruelly call the Dazed and Confused, which was everyone else. And I went down and I started seeing people in the breakfast area, and I was going, look at the state of that one. Go look at her. Look at him. And I didn't see the councillor come behind me, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and I went, he went, and you're in here as well, and it ain't a zoo. And they say we have these moments, these windows of opportunity, gifts, desperate, all that sort of stuff. And I just remember putting my knife and fork down and going back to my room, and I started crying. And I hadn't cried like that since I was a nipper. And he came up to see me and he said, are you all right? And I went, I said, it wasn't supposed to end like this. And he turned around and he said, you just said the most important thing you'll ever say. I went, what's that? He said, it's the end. And you know, one of those things, I didn't even know I said it, just rolled off the tongue. And he just turned around and he said, and guess what? And you lost. And I went, what am I going to do about it? He went, well, you've got one of two things you can do. You can either go back and get beat up a bit more and maybe not make it back here or wherever it is you're going to make yourself back to, or there's another way. And he said, come with me. And he took me for a drive around the Essex countryside. And I don't think he'd done that with all the others, so I'm special and different. I've got preferential treatment. And I just remember seeing all these signposts, Tilbury Juxta, Clare House, the Civil Wedding, all going around his Essex area. And by the time I got back, for want of a better term, he 12-step me. And I got back and I said to him, I said, right, where do we go from here? He said, we're not going to throw you out. You can see the end of your treatment out. But what you're going to do is you're going to behave. You're going to play ball and you're going to do exactly as you're told here. And when you're out of here, I was allowed out on July the 4th, 2009. I'm not American, but I thought it was quite poignant to be allowed out on Independence Day. And he said, when you leave here, he said, for your first year, not your first 90 days, your first year, you're going to eat shit, sleep, go to meetings and not pick up. I said, sorry, he went, you're going to eat shit. And it sounded like a lot. And I said to him, I said, I've seen it steps on the walls. I've heard people talk about sponsors. He said, well, you ain't going to meet a sponsor until you go to enough meetings to find a bloke you're going to sponsor by. And you ain't going to go through the steps to meet a sponsor. So you're going to go to these meetings, eat shit, sleep, and not pick up. And I took him at his word, and I was discharged on that Saturday. And I went back there on a Sunday night, there's a meeting there. There's a lady in here who was actually sharing that night. I'm looking at her now. And basically, the guy who I asked to sponsor me was standing outside, and he was laughing. And all I remember thinking, he was attractive because I didn't have a lot to bloody laugh about. And he found everything funny, and he was either mental or he was happy. I couldn't work it out. And I said to him at the time, I said, like there and then, I said, would you be my sponsor? He went, hold on. He said, didn't you just get discharged yesterday? I said, yes. He said, so what are you doing back here anyway? I said, I've come back here. I said, I've got myself a monthly rail card. I know where all the meetings are locally. And I'm going to have to do a fellowship because I can't do 90 of this particular NA in Essex because there was only 11 meetings a week at the time. And I couldn't get to South End and I couldn't get here. He went, slow down. Anyone who knows me, he was here earlier. When I was talking, basically, when I first met a guy in here, one of Dean's friends, and I was talking to him one day, and he just walked away and went, stimulants, was it? And just walked away and left. and a little bit of that, I think, still in the system. And what happened was basically, he said to me, he said, oh, you wouldn't go to any lamps, all the stuff we're saying, and I said, oh, yeah. And he said, do you know these meetings in London? I went, is that? And I didn't know. I thought I was in this little bubble, right, where this little coach took us to. I didn't know nothing about all of this. And I started coming down into meetings, and I did 1990, I did 30, 1660, I did 1990. I went to a meeting every day for my first 2 years. I actually done 700 meetings my first year. I was telling Penny before, and what happened is basically, I've done my 1990, and I wrote them all down on an A4 sheet of paper. And this is where anyone who knows me knows what I'm like. I scanned this bit of paper onto my computer, turned it into an Excel spreadsheet, and I carried on adding to it. And what I've done is that every meeting I've ever been to is on a spreadsheet. Right? And then I thought, one day I'm going to be a secretary, so I'm going to start putting names of people just in case they're a good step share, they're a good time. And this is my 1801st meeting in 2,756 days. I know these things. And I've got a clean time calendar. Anyone who knows that knows. And that was my first service commitment. Someone says, start a clean time calendar. And I was doing it in a diary, and I thought, I ain't going to buy a diary. I'll just put it on Google. And then what happened, as my world expanded, and I got to know more and more people, and I go to meetings, and I do social media, and people just mention it, and I just add it to the calendar. And then lo and behold, basically, people get a text, people get a message, people get whatever, and it's like, I've got nearly 5,000 people on my clean time calendar. And this is why this stuff here means the world to me, because it's like, well, I don't care if I fall out with you, I don't like you, whatever else, I really appreciate and I really like celebrating other people's achievements. When people go on holiday, I'm like, getting. When people get married, when people have kids, when people do all this, I'm like, do you know what, because I know where we all come from. We come from a place where basically it wasn't nice, right? And any sort of that sort of stuff to me is really, really important. Anyway, getting back to that sponsor, he said something to me, and funny enough, my other two sponsors since have said the same thing, which is basically said, you are not that important that the buck stops with you. He said, basically, he said, if I'm going to sponsor you, you will sponsor somebody else. You're not that important that you're in the production of. You will sponsor somebody. I don't know when, but you will. And that's the same thing I say to sponsors today. That's basically the only sort of criteria I set. And what happened, we started going about the work. His sponsor's been around years, you know, didn't you? Yes, basically. And what happened was we were working through these basic text worksheets that came with the basic text that came out before the set working guide, because this bloke got clean in 1900 and frozen stiff or something. And we were working through this work and basic, and all I was doing was I was going to meetings, sitting in a drop-in, not doing step work. That's all I did for my first year. My first step four, which didn't include the stuff about being a rent boy, that's what it was. When all that sort of thing, and I didn't include, and that my first step four was 350 sides of A4 paper, and I still left that out. And the last question was, is there anything you left out? And I went, yeah, but I ain't going to tell you. Because I wasn't ready to tell them. It weren't anything. It was, I've worked out really the best of my ability ain't always the best of my ability. It's the best I can come up with on that given day. And I remember he came around my house and it was the day before we were going on holiday, and we'd done an 8-hour step five, and we went through this, had a two pizza delivered, locked the door, went, you stay until it's done. And we went through this work, and that evening we were going to a meeting in Chelmsford again. And the chair didn't turn up, and the secretary said, Scott, do you want to do the chair? My sponsor went, sit down, you ain't do it, I've heard you, I'll do it. And he did the chair, and when I opened the meeting up, I had nothing left, I was just spent, and I just had nothing more to give of it. And he drove me home that night, and as I was getting out of the car, it was one of those little bottom-lip moments. He turned around and he said, welcome to recovery. And I said, what have I been doing for the last 6-7 months? He said, running away from your last user. He said, now you've done this work. He said, there's still a lot to do, and there's a long, long way to go. But you know what, from here on in, enjoy the view. It's not about running up to the top of the mountain and putting the flag in first. It's not a race. It's not a competition. Get on with it, right? If this works for you going at this pace, great. But the thing is, enjoy. Start having some fun. Enjoy this. That's what this is about. And I took that. And anyone who knows, I like an holiday. and I put myself about. And the thing is, it's like it's conventions. This and the thing is, and what I did is I worked out really quick how to get the balance right. And it's that's the elusive thing. I've always said there's no skill to what we do. But there's an art, and the art is balance. And it does feel kilter every good day. I mean, I spend lots of quality time with my missus. I've got a job to keep. I've got this. I've got that. And I've got a recovery to keep. And the thing is, any given day it can fall out. Something like Christmas, your structure goes out the window. So the thing is, it's always making sure that, and that's my main job, is making sure, it's not a control issue, it's making sure that I've got enough meetings, I'm making enough focus, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. As I said, my nearest meeting to me is 25 miles away, and I don't drive. But I still manage to get 3 meetings a week. It's not a problem. I spend most of my time on the phone if I'm not in a meeting. So, you know what I mean? And it's, I do like quoting from the book, but in What Can I Do, when it says, we don't adapt the programme to our life, we adapt our life to the programme. And what it is when people say to me today, what have you done for your recovery? I go, well, I got up, I prayed, I had a bit, I made myself a salad, I went to work all day, I behaved at work, I didn't get a sack, and then I went to a meeting, then I went home, I'm going to kiss the missus, I'm going to make her a cup of tea and go to bed. That's what I did for my recovery today. When I just went to a meeting and talked to the sponsor, the whole thing, it's one and the same thing. And I do this as if my life depends on it, because it does. And that's never changed. That's the way I feel about it now, is the way I felt about it then. This comes first. When I got discharged, I said to my missus there and then, I said, the most important thing in my life is, you're the most important person in my life, but the most important thing is this. And she went, I'll hold you to that. And that stayed the case. And as I said, I mean, she's got her own recovery, and sometimes our house is amazing. Like, it's 24 steps being worked, and the cats are purring, and it's lovely. Then there's times she's working my 12, I'm working her 12, and it all gets a bit on top. It's like, you know what I mean? So there is, sometimes it's a double-edged sword living with someone in recovery, it really is. And the thing is, and it's that thing where what's come of it is there's a mutual respect. And the last 7.5 years has been fantastic. That first year and a half, and I've done all I... Do you know what, I throw this out there, it's not dismissive, it's not flippant. I'm nostalgic and reminiscent about my first year when all I had to do was stay clean. Before I had responsibilities, I was unemployable, I couldn't get a job anyway. I didn't have to work, I had the good luck of basically someone's keeping the roof over my head. I was blessed, as I said. But all I had to do was that, and all of a sudden now I've got a job, I've got this, I've got other stuff. I'll let you know exactly what's gone on in that time. But I look back at that first year, it's almost like when you say your school days are your best and you sound like an old man. And I miss that first year when all I had to do was drink coffee, sit in meetings and talk bloody steps and talk recovery. I do miss it. I was 18 months clean and I was running from a meeting to a meeting as I do. And I snapped my ankle clean. I got calcium deficiencies, years and years of amphetamine, that is. And what happened was I was on crutches and I started getting this pain here and I thought it was a hernia or a groin strain. And I had it checked out and, well, I didn't have it checked out. I went on for a few weeks till my missus went, I can't be having you. You're going to see the bloody doctor. And I went to see the doctor and he told me I had testicular cancer, which I wasn't expecting. They threw me. How can I get out? Why me? And I remember my sponsor and his sponsor both saying, why not? And I underwent treatment, and I had to have an orchidectomy. Until then, I didn't know I even had a pair of orchids. and basically, and I had to undergo radiotherapy. There was all sorts of other stuff going on. I had to sort of biopsies and all sorts of malarkey. And then all them consequences of that physical jumping out of window malarkey started coming back and biting me. First thing to go was the shoulder. I think it's put my arm up in meetings that made the shoulder go. So, yeah. And the shoulder went, and I had an arthroscopy, and then I had to rebuild the shoulder. So by the time I was 2 years in, I remember doing my 2 year birthday share, and I had my foot in plaster. I got my arm in a sling, and one of my balls were in a jar, and I was telling them how grateful I was. But the funny thing was, I genuinely meant it. That was the thing. People were looking at me like, there's something wrong with him, but there is something wrong with him. And the thing, and it comes to that thing, is that I am genuinely enthusiastic about what I do. I'm that annoying person who wakes up like that, full of beans. I regress as the day continues. By now, I'm tired now. My missus woke me up in the middle of the night, so. And I came through all that. And I remember I was telling Dean earlier, I said I was having the surgery done. And I remember saying to the doctor at the time, I said, look, I'm really, really worried about taking medication and those sort of things. I'm in early recovery and I've been reading the Times of Illness, and he was right in the way, and he turned around and he looked at me and he went, I'm 25 years clean, get over yourself. I said, pardon? He went, I'm 25 years clean, get over yourself. He said, do you work a programme? Yeah. And he said to me, he said, have you got a programme? I said, yeah, I went, fucking work it. Didn't even look up. And you know, in that instant, I was all right. When I did my first step three was really along the lines of, right, I've got to do this because there are another 9 steps and I want to work 12 steps. And my first step three was basically handing my wheel over to this programme. That's how I understood it. And to an extent, it's still the same. Step two is you lot. The three is obviously when you lot ain't about. I won't recommend or suggest getting a step three, how I understand it now, is when you're actually in a cancer ward and the guy in the bed opposite you dies, there and then eating his cornflakes, and they pull a curtain around and they clean the bed and all of a sudden there's no one there, and you've got no charge on your phone, and you can't make a call in the ward anyway, you start praying properly. And all I remember is in that moment, it was like, it wasn't Scott's going to be all right, it's going to be all right. It didn't mean I was going to be all right, and I just got to say, it's going to be all right. And it was. I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. And thereafter, basically, I spent the next 3 or 4 years I had 2013 in hindsight. I got the all clear from the cancer. We moved down to Basingstoke because my wife's parents, her mum's got Alzheimer's and her dad's health was not too well. And then her dad died just after not long after we moved there. And we had to sell her mum's house to pay for her care, and I'm a power of attorney. I've got a responsibility of being my mother-in-law's power of attorney. This is a woman who wouldn't have me in her house for 20 years. And as I said, we look after all the finance side, we look after the health side and that side of things. In between, my knee started playing up, and I had an arthroscopy on my left knee. Then they said I needed a knee replacement. I had a full knee replacement. I had the good fortune of going into private hospital without getting my missus' care. My amends to my missus' office is stop being ill and stop being a git. But they paid for this care, and what it was is I was petrified because I knew that this was a big op. And I was in there, and I just remember, this is actually my thing. There was a sponsor of mine who he said to me, see, when you come out of hospital, I'll go and read that step one. See, I went, no, you won't. You'll come to the bloody hospital and you read it to me in there. I need it as much as you do, if not more. And he came up and read his one while I was actually sitting there on a morphine drip. So that in itself is quite surreal. You know, I mean, my knee was this big, but I anaesthetic, the following day it was morphine drip, the following day it was on Oramorph, then it was on codeine phosphate, then cocodamol. By the time I was ready to be discharged on a Saturday, this is my story, this ain't putting it out there and telling anyone else they're doing it wrong, right, this is for me. I was just left with a paracetamol. Right, and then the thing is, they said, as many as you needed, like 4 or 2 times, and what I did was I went and stayed with my mum. She lives in a bungalow. I couldn't get around in my own house because I've got stairs in it. This is the woman who threw me out at 15 years old. This is the woman who gave me a front door key to go back into her house 33 years later. I was on crutches. I won't nick anything and jump over the wall anyway, you know what I mean? But the thing is, and I spent a lot of time with my mum, and the thing is, I've made my amends to her a little while earlier, and I remember saying to my mum, I didn't actually apologise as such. I just said to her, what was it like being my mum? And she said, the worst thing about being your mum was not waiting for that phone call. The worst thing about being your mum was wanting that phone call. She went, I didn't want my little boy dead, but guess what? If you'd have died, it would have all been over. And that was, boom, that was, and I just, and the only thing I could just say to her is like, that's not going to happen anymore. And that's that. It ain't going to happen anymore. Whatever happens, and it's like, and we're all right now. I must admit, spending 8 weeks living with my mum at the age of 47 was, you know what I mean? Because it's her house, and I was her little boy, and it was like, and we clash. But the thing is, I phone her every Monday, I phone her every Thursday, I tell her I love her, she talks to me about all stuff that I'm not really going about, but anyway. And I listen, I acknowledge, and it's all cool. It's all cool. We're a long, long way from where we were. We didn't talk for the best part of 20 years. And when I made my amends to my sister just turned around and said, look, I'm not willing to do this, I don't care. She went, all I know is, you stop making her cry. I just pointed over at my mum. And then Christmas last, I was on crutches again, with a knee malarkey. And I went and had Christmas dinner with my sister and my mum for the first time since 1982. That's a long, long time. My sister at the moment, she's going for a divorce. She's been with the same guy since she was 13, 14 years old. It's a big, big deal and the rest of it. And she phoned me up a few months ago. And she just told me, she goes, I just want to have a chat with my big brother. She had called me that since I was about 9 and she was about 6. That's how I see this, is the ripple of active addiction is you smash and destroy and explode and detonate everything around you. The ripple effect of being in recovery is, it's not you get that back, you just basically get that. When I said to my mum, I'm glad to have you back in my life, she went, I never went anywhere, I'm still here. If you went, you know what I mean? So I didn't get it back, it'd never gone away, I went. So sense of the things, and what's happened over the last couple of years or so, it's calmed down on the health front. I'm 2 years general anaesthetic free. It's a big deal. Someone who's had 9 surgeries in recovery in 7.5 years, I mean, you know what I mean? That's a lot of surgery I've had. And there's a lot of trauma that comes with that sort of stuff. And as I said, and I will say again, the guy I'm working with, who's been working with me now for the last 4.5 years, because of my background, because of sex worker, rent boy, whatever it was, I've always had a really, really big mistrust of men. I struggle around men full stop. I've got lots of girlfriends, as friends who are girls. I grew up with my mum, my sister, my aunt, and my nan. And I find I really get on with women. And the thing is, and it's not because I'm on their case or because I've got my kryptonite on or anything like that. I've got loads and loads of friends who are girls. And I find myself easy in their company. But I also find I can manipulate and take that situation. But the point is, it's been really, really difficult and a struggle for me sometimes to actually be honest. So there's about 2 or 3 men in my life who I can do that with. And that's taken time. And I still find myself holding myself back and I don't want to give all of that. But that's come with time, and the person I'm working with has helped me get out of my shell. And as I said, I've got about 9 sponsors. I've got 4 active sponsors. But people ask me, they say, will you be my sponsor? I say, yep, call me, never hear from again, but they still tell people I'm their sponsor, them sponsors. But there's 4 sponsors who are active sponsors. And do you know what, and the strange thing is, 3 of them are married men and the other one's been in long-term relationships. So I don't know if that's something else I'll bring to the table, because obviously, anyone who knows what I do, because I'm quite public about my own achievements, about our holidays and everything else we're doing. I was saying planning before we started is when I gave up smoking 4 years ago, and what I do every week is I put the equivalent of my cigarette money into a jar, and then every month I put it into a bank. And I've saved $13,000 in the last 4 years, and I've been to Thailand 3 times, I've been to Florida twice, I've been on 2 cruises, I've been to Cyprus, Cape Verde, and we're going to Thailand again 4 weeks today for 3 weeks, and it's all coming out of my no-smoking fund. Fuck knows what my gear fund would have been like, you know, I don't know. But the thing is, what it is, it's another one of those things, it was a big deal to give up. I've been smoking since I was 12, 13 years old, it's a reward system. And I come in here beat up, and I don't want to beat myself up anymore, and I'm like a lot of people in here who continues to beat themselves up. And the first, I could do 1,000 great things in a day, and I do something stupid when I get indoors, and the first thing I do is, what do you do that for? I don't call anyone else that a C-word, but I call myself that when I stumble in, you silly. You know what I mean? I'm still sort of learning to sort of be good to Scott, be nice to Scott. I'm doing all right. loads I didn't say. Have I got left? Oh, okay. Loads I'd like to say. I said to Daniel, I said, I'm going to get it all in 40, I want it in a 3-part trilogy. but I think I've sort of wrapped up nicely. Yeah, the keep coming back bit, why not? What have you got to lose, apart from everything? It's changed my life. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. It's long may it continue. I was talking to someone earlier and I just sort of said to them, I said, do you know what, anyone in here who thinks they're never going to use again don't really know what they suffer from. Right? And the thing is, and this the way I look in now for today, I'm not scared of being an addict. I'm not scared of my addiction. I treat it. I respect my condition. And as long as I respect it and I treat it accordingly, I've got nothing to worry about. As long as I follow this way, I've got nothing to fear. If I don't follow this way, I've got everything to be frightened of. So basically, yeah. So for all the things I didn't say, I'll go home and kick myself for. For all the things I thought, I didn't think I was going to say that in public, I'll kick myself for. I'm glad it's over and done with. Yeah, thank you.